The intellectual roots of the Third Reich. But aside from history, where did Hitler get his ideas? Though his opponents inside and outside Germany were too busy or too stupid to take much notice of it until it was too late, he had somehow absorbed, as had so many Germans, a weird mixture of the irresponsible, megalomaniacal ideas which erupted from German thinkers during the 19th century. Hitler, who often got them at second hand through such a muddled pseudo-philosopher as Alfred Rosenberg or through his drunken poet friend Dietrich Eckart, embraced them with all the feverish enthusiasm of a neophyte. What was worse, he resolved to put them into practice if the opportunity should ever arise. We have seen what they were as they thrashed about in Hitler's mind, the glorification of war and conquest, and the absolute power of the authoritarian state, the belief in the Aryans, or Germans, as the master race, and the hatred of Jews and Slavs, the contempt for democracy and humanism. They are not original with Hitler, though the means of applying them later proved to be. They emanate from that odd assortment of erudite but unbalanced philosophers, historians, and teachers who captured the German mind during the century before Hitler, with consequences so disastrous, as it turned out, not only for the Germans, but for a large portion of mankind. There had been among the Germans, to be sure, some of the most elevated minds and spirits of the Western world. Leibniz, Kant, Herder, Humboldt, Lessing, Goethe, Schiller, Bach, and Beethoven. And they had made unique contributions to the civilization of the West. But the German culture which became dominant in the 19th century, and which coincided with the rise of Prussian Germany, continuing from Bismarck through Hitler, rests primarily on Fichte and Hegel, to begin with, and then on Treitschke, Nietzsche, Richard Wagner, and a host of lesser lights, not the least of whom, strangely enough, were a bizarre Frenchman and an eccentric Englishman. They succeeded in establishing a spiritual break with the West. The breach has not been healed to this day. In 1807, following Prussia's humiliating defeat by Napoleon at Jena, Johann Gottlieb Fichte began his famous Addresses to the German Nation from the podium of the University of Berlin, where he held the chair of philosophy. They stirred and rallied a divided, defeated people, and their resounding echoes could still be heard in the Third Reich. Fichte's teaching was heady wine for a frustrated folk. To him, the Latins, especially the French, and the Jews are the decadent races. Only the Germans possess the possibility of regeneration. Their language is the purest, the most original. Under them, a new era in history would blossom. It would reflect the order of the cosmos. It would be led by a small elite which would be free of any moral restraints of a private nature. These are some of the ideas we have seen Hitler putting down in Mein Kampf. On Fichte's death in 1814, he was succeeded by Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel at the University of Berlin. This is the subtle and penetrating mind whose dialectics inspired Marx and Lenin, and thus contributed to the founding of communism, and whose ringing glorification of the state as supreme in human life paved the way for the Second and Third Reichs of Bismarck and Hitler. To Hegel, the state is all, or almost all. Among other things, he says, it is the highest revelation of the world spirit. It is the moral universe. It is the actuality of the ethical idea, ethical mind, knowing and thinking itself. The state has the supreme right against the individual, whose supreme duty is to be a member of the state, for the right of the world spirit is above all special privileges. And the happiness of the individual on earth? Hegel replies that world history is no empire of happiness. The periods of happiness, he declares, are the empty pages of history because they are the periods of agreement without conflict. War is the great purifier. In Hegel's view, it makes for the ethical health of peoples corrupted by a long peace, as the blowing of the winds preserves the sea from the foulness which would be the result of a prolonged calm. No traditional conception of morals and ethics must disturb either the supreme state or the heroes who lead it. World history occupies a higher ground. Moral claims which are irrelevant must not be brought into collision with world historical deeds and their accomplishments. The litany of private virtues modesty, humility, philanthropy, and forbearance must not be raised against them. So mighty a form, the state, must trample down many an innocent flower, crush to pieces many an object in its path. Hegel foresees such a state for Germany when she has recovered her God-given genius. He predicts that Germany's hour will come, and that its mission will be to regenerate the world. As one reads Hegel, one realizes how much inspiration Hitler, like Marx, drew from him, even if it was at second hand. Above all else, Hegel, in his theory of heroes, those great agents who are fated by a mysterious providence to carry out the will of the world spirit, seems to have inspired Hitler, as we shall see at the end of this chapter, with his own overpowering sense of mission. Heinrich von Treitschke came later to the University of Berlin. From 1874 until his death in 1896, he was a professor of history there, and a popular one, his lectures being attended by large and enthusiastic gatherings, which included not only students, but general staff officers and officials of the Junker bureaucracy. His influence on German thought in the last quarter of the century was enormous, and it continued through Wilhelm II's day, and indeed Hitler's. Though he was a Saxon, he became the great Prussianizer. He was more Prussian than the Prussians. Like Hegel, he glorifies the state and conceives of it as supreme, but his attitude is more brutish. The people, the subjects, are to be little more than slaves in the nation. "It does not matter what you think," he exclaims, "so long as you obey." And Treitschke outdoes Hegel in proclaiming war as the highest expression of man. To him, martial glory is the basis of all the political virtues. In the rich treasure of Germany's glories, the Prussian military glory is a jewel as precious as the masterpieces of our poets and thinkers. He holds that to play blindly with peace has become the shame of the thought and morality of our age. War is not only a practical necessity, it is also a theoretical necessity, an exigency of logic. The concept of the state implies the concept of war, for the essence of the state is power. That war should ever be banished from the world is a hope not only absurd, but profoundly immoral. It would involve the atrophy of many of the essential and sublime forces of the human soul. A people which become attached to the chimerical hope of perpetual peace finishes irremediably by decaying in its proud isolation. Nietzsche, like Goethe, held no high opinion of the German people. "I have often felt," Goethe once said, "a bitter sorrow at the thought of the German people, which is so estimable in the individual and so wretched in the generality. A comparison of the German people with other peoples arouses a painful feeling, which I try to overcome in every possible way." Conversation with H. Luden on December 13, 1813, in Goethe's Gespräche. Auswahl Biedermann, quoted by Wilhelm Rübke in The Solution of the German Problem, page 131. And in other ways, too, the outpourings of this megalomaniacal genius differ from those of the chauvinistic German thinkers of the 19th century. Indeed, he regarded most German philosophers, including Fichte and Hegel, as unconscious swindlers. He poked fun at the Tartuffery of old Kant. "The Germans," he wrote in Ecce Homo, "have no conception how vile they are," and he came to the conclusion that wheresoever Germany penetrated, she ruins culture. He thought that Christians, as much as Jews, were responsible for the slave morality prevalent in the world. He was never an anti-Semite. He was sometimes fearful of Prussia's future, and in his last years, before insanity closed down his mind, he even toyed with the idea of European Union and world government. Yet I think no one who lived in the Third Reich could have failed to be impressed by Nietzsche's influence on it. His books might be full, as Santayana said, of genial imbecility and boyish blasphemies. Yet Nazi scribblers never tired of extolling him. Hitler often visited the Nietzsche Museum in Weimar and publicized his veneration for the philosopher by posing for photographs of himself staring in rapture at the bust of the great man. There was some ground for this appropriation of Nietzsche as one of the originators of the Nazi Weltanschauung. Had not the philosopher thundered against democracy and parliaments, preached the will to power, praised war and proclaimed the coming of the master race and the Superman, and in the most telling aphorisms? A Nazi could proudly quote him on almost every conceivable subject, and did. on Christianity. The one great curse, the one enormous and innermost perversion, I call it the one immortal blemish of mankind. This Christianity is no more than the typical teaching of the socialists on the state, power, and the jungle world of man. Society has never regarded virtue as anything else than as a means to strength, power, and order. The state is unmorality organized, the will to war, to conquest, and revenge. Society is not entitled to exist for its own sake, but only as a substructure and scaffolding, by means of which a select race of beings may elevate themselves to their higher duties. There is no such thing as the right to live, the right to work, or the right to be happy. In this respect, man is no different from the meanest worm. And he exalted the Superman as the beast of prey, the magnificent blonde brute, avidly rampant for spoil and victory. Women, whom Nietzsche never had, he consigned to a distinctly inferior status, as did the Nazis, who decreed that their place was in the kitchen and their chief role in life to beget children for German warriors. Nietzsche put the idea this way: man shall be trained for war and woman for the procreation of the warrior. All else is folly. He went further. In Thus Spake Zarathustra, he exclaims, "Thou goest to woman? Do not forget thy whip," which prompted Bertrand Russell to quip, "Nine women out of ten would have got the whip away from him, and he knew it, so he kept away from women." And war? Here Nietzsche took the view of most of the other 19th-century German thinkers. In the thundering Old Testament language in which Thus Spake Zarathustra is written, the philosopher cries out, "Ye shall love peace as a means to new war, and the short peace more than the long. You I advise not to work, but to fight. You I advise not to peace, but to victory. Ye say it is the good cause which halloweth even war. I say unto you, it is the good war which halloweth every cause. War and courage have done more great things than charity." Finally, there was Nietzsche's prophecy of the coming elite who would rule the world and from whom the Superman would spring. In The Will to Power, he exclaims, "A daring and ruler race is building itself up. The aim should be to prepare a transvaluation of values for a particularly strong kind of man, most highly gifted in intellect and will. This man and the elite around him will become the lords of the earth." Such rantings from one of Hitler's most original minds must have struck a responsive chord in Hitler's littered mind. At any rate, he appropriated them for his own. Not only the thoughts, but the philosopher's penchant for grotesque exaggeration, and often his very words. "Lords of the earth" is a familiar expression in Mein Kampf. That in the end Hitler considered himself the Superman of Nietzsche's prophecy cannot be doubted. "Whoever wants to understand National Socialist Germany must know Wagner," Hitler used to say. My own recollection is confirmed by Otto Tolisches in his They Wanted War, page 11. This may have been based on a partial misconception of the great composer, for though Richard Wagner harbored a fanatical hatred, as Hitler did, for the Jews, who he was convinced were out to dominate the world with their money, and though he scorned parliaments and democracy and the materialism and mediocrity of the bourgeoisie, he also fervently hoped that the Germans, with their special gifts, would become not rulers, but ennoblers of the world. It was not his political writings, however, but his towering operas, recalling so vividly the world of German antiquity with its heroic myths, its fighting pagan gods and heroes, its demons and dragons, its blood feuds and primitive tribal codes, its sense of destiny, of the splendor of love and life and the nobility of death, which inspired the myths of modern Germany and gave it a Germanic Weltanschauung which Hitler and the Nazis, with some justification, took over as their own. From his earliest days, Hitler worshipped Wagner, and even as his life neared a close in the damp and dreary bunker at army headquarters on the Russian front, with his world and his dreams beginning to crack and crumble, he loved to reminisce about all the times he had heard the great Wagnerian works, of what they had meant to him and of the inspiration he had derived from the Bayreuth Festival and from his countless visits to Haus Wahnfried, the composer's home, where Siegfried Wagner, the composer's son, still lived with his English-born wife, Winifred, who for a while was one of his revered friends. "What joy each of Wagner's works has given me," Hitler exclaims on the evening of January 24th to 25th, 1942, soon after the first disastrous German defeats in Russia, as he discourses to his generals and party cronies, Himmler among them, in the depths of the underground shelter of Wolfschanze at Rostenburg in East Prussia. Outside there is snow and an Arctic cold, the elements which he so hated and feared, and which had contributed to the first German military setback of the war. But in the warmth of the bunker, his thoughts on this night, at least, are on one of the great inspirations of his life. "I remember," he says, "my emotion the first time I entered Wahnfried. To say I was moved is an understatement. At my worst moments, they never ceased to sustain me, even Siegfried Wagner. I was on Christian-name terms with them. I loved them all, and I also loved Wahnfried. The 10 days of the Bayreuth season were always one of the blessed seasons of my existence, and I rejoice at the idea that one day I shall be able to resume the pilgrimage. On the day following the end of the Bayreuth festival, I'm gripped by a great sadness, as when one strips the Christmas tree of its ornaments." Though Hitler reiterated in his monologue that winter evening that to him Tristan und Isolde was Wagner's masterpiece, it is the stupendous Nibelungen Ring, a series of four operas which was inspired by the great German epic myth Nibelungenlied, and on which the composer worked for the better part of 25 years, that gave Germany, and especially the Third Reich, so much of its primitive Germanic mythos. Often a people's myths are the highest and truest expression of its spirit and culture, and nowhere is this more true than in Germany. Schelling even argued that a nation comes into existence with its mythology. The unity of its thinking, which means a collective philosophy, is presented in its mythology. Therefore, its mythology contains the fate of the nation. And Max Mell, a contemporary poet, who wrote a modern version of the Song of the Nibelungs, declared, "Today only little has remained of the Greek gods that humanism wanted to implant so deeply into our culture. But Siegfried and Kriemhild were always in the people's soul." Siegfried and Kriemhild, Brunhild and Hagen, these are the ancient heroes and heroines with whom so many modern Germans liked to identify themselves. With them, and with the world of the barbaric pagan Nibelungs, an irrational, heroic, mystic world, beset by treachery, overwhelmed by violence, drowned in blood, and culminating in the Götterdämmerung, the twilight of the gods, as Valhalla, set on fire by Wotan after all his vicissitudes, goes up in flames in an orgy of self-willed annihilation, which has always fascinated the German mind and answered some terrible longing in the German soul. These heroes, this primitive demonic world, were always, in Mell's words, in the people's soul. In that German soul could be felt the struggle between the spirit of civilization and the spirit of the Nibelungs. And in the time with which this history is concerned, the latter seemed to gain the upper hand. It is not at all surprising that Hitler tried to emulate Wotan when in 1945 he willed the destruction of Germany so that it might go down in flames with him. Wagner, a man of staggering genius, an artist of incredible magnitude, stood for much more than has been set down here. The conflict in the Ring operas often revolves around the theme of greed for gold, which the composer equated with the tragedy of modern capitalism, and which he saw with horror wiping out the old virtues which had come down from an earlier day. Despite all his pagan heroes, he did not entirely despair of Christianity, as Nietzsche did. And he had great compassion for the erring, warring human race. But Hitler was not entirely wrong in saying that to understand Nazism, one must first know Wagner. Wagner had known and been influenced by first Schopenhauer and then Nietzsche, though the latter quarreled with him because he thought his operas, especially Parsifal, showed too much Christian renunciation. In the course of his long and stormy life, Wagner came into contact with two other men, one a Frenchman, the other an Englishman, who are important to this history not so much for the impression they made on him, though in one case it was considerable, as for their effect on the German mind, which they helped to direct toward the coming of the Third Reich. These individuals were Count Joseph Arthur de Gobineau, a French diplomat and man of letters, and Houston Stuart Chamberlain, one of the strangest Englishmen who ever lived. Neither man, be it said at once, was a mountebank. Both were men of immense erudition, deep culture, and wide experience of travel. Yet both concocted racial doctrines so spurious that no people, not even their own, took them seriously, with the single exception of the Germans. To the Nazis, their questionable theories became gospel. It is probably no exaggeration to say, as I have heard more than one follower of Hitler say, that Chamberlain was the spiritual founder of the Third Reich. This singular Englishman, who came to see in the Germans the master race, the hope of the future, worshipped Richard Wagner, one of whose daughters he eventually married. He venerated first Wilhelm II and finally Hitler, and was the mentor of both. At the end of a fantastic life, he could hail the Austrian corporal, and this long before Hitler came to power or had any prospect of it, as being sent by God to lead the German people out of the wilderness. Hitler, not unnaturally, regarded Chamberlain as a prophet, as indeed he turned out to be. What was it in the teaching of these two men that inoculated the Germans with a madness on the question of race and German destiny? Gobineau's chief contribution was a four-volume work which was published in Paris between 1853 and 1855, entitled Essai sur l'inégalité des races humaines, Essay on the Inequality of the Human Races. Ironically enough, this French aristocrat, after serving as an officer in the Royal Guard, had started his public career as chef du cabinet to Alexis de Tocqueville, when the distinguished author of Democracy in America served a brief term of office in 1848. He had then gone to Hanover and Frankfurt as a diplomat, and it was from his contact with the Germans, rather than with de Tocqueville, that he derived his theories on racial inequalities, though he once confessed that he wrote the volumes partly to prove the superiority of his own aristocratic ancestry. To Gobineau, as he stated in his dedication of the work to the King of Hanover, the key to history and civilization was race. The racial question dominates all the other problems of history. The inequality of races suffices to explain the whole unfolding of the destiny of peoples. There were three principal races, white, yellow, and black, and the white was the superior. History, he contended, shows that all civilization flows from the white race, that no civilization can exist without the cooperation of this race. The jewel of the white race was the Aryan. This illustrious human family, the noblest among the white race, whose origins he traced back to Central Asia. Unfortunately, Gobineau says, the contemporary Aryan suffered from intermixture with inferior races, as one could see in the southern Europe of his time. However, in the northwest, above a line running roughly along the Seine and east to Switzerland, the Aryans, though far from Simon Pure, still survived as a superior race. This took in some of the French, all of the English and the Irish, the people of the Low Countries and the Rhine and Hanover, and the Scandinavians. Gobineau seemingly excluded the bulk of the Germans, who lived to the east and southeast of his line, a fact which the Nazis glossed over when they embraced his teachings. Still, to Gobineau's mind, the Germans, or at least the West Germans, were probably the best of all the Aryans, and this discovery the Nazis did not gloss over. Wherever they went, the Germans, he found, brought improvement. This was true even in the Roman Empire. The so-called barbaric German tribes who conquered the Romans and broke up their empire did a distinct service to civilization, for the Romans, by the time of the 4th century, were little better than degenerate mongrels, while the Germans were relatively pure Aryans. The Aryan German, he declared, is a powerful creature. Everything he thinks, says, and does is thus of major importance. Gobineau's ideas were quickly taken up in Germany. Wagner, whom the Frenchman met in 1876 toward the close of his life, he died in 1882, espoused them with enthusiasm, and soon Gobineau's societies sprang up all over Germany, though not in France. The Strange Life and Works of H.S. Chamberlain. Among the zealous members of the Gobineau Society in Germany was Houston Stuart Chamberlain, whose life and works constitute one of the most fascinating ironies in the inexorable course of history which led to the rise and fall of the Third Reich. This son of an English admiral, nephew of a British field marshal, Sir Neville Chamberlain, and of two British generals, and eventually son-in-law of Richard Wagner, was born at Portsmouth in 1855. He was destined for the British Army or Navy, but his delicate health made such a calling out of the question, and he was educated in France and Geneva, where French became his first language. Between the ages of 15 and 19, fate brought him into touch with two Germans, and thereafter he was drawn irresistibly toward Germany, of which he ultimately became a citizen and one of the foremost thinkers, and in whose language he wrote all of his many books, several of which had an almost blinding influence on Wilhelm II, Adolf Hitler, and countless lesser Germans. In 1870, when he was 15, Chamberlain landed in the hands of a remarkable tutor, Otto Kunze, a Prussian of the Prussians, who for 4 years imprinted on his receptive mind and sensitive soul the glories of militant conquering Prussia, and also, apparently unmindful of the contrasts, of such artists and poets as Beethoven, Goethe, Schiller, and Wagner. At 19, Chamberlain fell madly in love with Anna Horst, also a Prussian, 10 years his senior and, like him, highly neurotic. In 1882, at the age of 27, he journeyed from Geneva, where he had been immersed for 3 years in studies of philosophy, natural history, physics, chemistry, and medicine, to Bayreuth. There he met Wagner, who, as he says, became the sun of his life, and Cosima, the composer's wife, to whom he would remain passionately and slavishly devoted all the rest of his days. From 1885, when he went with Anna Horst, who had become his wife, to live for 4 years in Dresden, he became a German in thought and in language, moving on to Vienna in 1889 for a decade, and finally in 1909 to Bayreuth, where he dwelt until his death in 1927. He divorced his idolized Prussian wife in 1905, when she was 60 and even more mentally and physically ill than he. The separation was so painful that he said it almost drove him mad. And 3 years later he married Eva Wagner and settled down near Wanfried, where he could be near his wife's mother, the revered, strong-willed Cosima. Hypersensitive and neurotic and subject to frequent nervous breakdowns, Chamberlain was given to seeing demons who, by his own account, drove him on relentlessly to seek new fields of study and get on with his prodigious writings. One vision after another forced him to change from biology to botany to the fine arts, to music, to philosophy, to biography, to history. Once in 1896, when he was returning from Italy, the presence of a demon became so forceful that he got off the train at Gardone, shut himself up in a hotel room for 8 days, and, abandoning some work on music that he had contemplated, wrote feverishly on a biological thesis until he had the germ of the theme that would dominate all of his later works: race and history. Whatever its blemishes, his mind had a vast sweep ranging over the fields of literature, music, biology, botany, religion, history, and politics. There was, as Jean Réal has pointed out, a profound unity of inspiration in all his published works, and they had a remarkable coherence. Since he felt himself goaded on by demons, his books on Wagner, Goethe, Kant, Christianity, and race were written in the grip of a terrible fever, a veritable trance, a state of self-induced intoxication, so that, as he says in his autobiography, Lebenswege, he was often unable to recognize them as his own work because they surpassed his expectations. Minds more balanced than his have subsequently demolished his theories of race and much of his history. And to such a French scholar of Germanism as Edmond Vermeil, Chamberlain's ideas were essentially shoddy. Yet to the anti-Nazi German biographer of Hitler, Konrad Haydn, who deplored the influence of his racial teachings, Chamberlain was one of the most astonishing talents in the history of the German mind, a mine of knowledge and profound ideas. The book which most profoundly influenced that mind, which sent Wilhelm II into ecstasies and provided the Nazis with their racial aberrations, was Foundations of the 19th Century, Grundlagen des 19. Jahrhunderts, a work of some 1,200 pages, which Chamberlain, again possessed of one of his demons, wrote in 19 months between April 1, 1897 and October 31, 1898, in Vienna, and which was published in 1899. As with Gobineau, whom he admired, Chamberlain found the key to history, indeed the basis of civilization, to be race. To explain the 19th century, that is, the contemporary world, one had to consider first what it had been bequeathed from ancient times. Three things, said Chamberlain: Greek philosophy and art, Roman law, and the personality of Christ. There were also three legatees, the Jews and the Germans, the two pure races, and the half-breed Latins of the Mediterranean, a chaos of peoples, he called them. The Germans alone deserved such a splendid heritage. They had, it is true, come into history late, not until the 13th century. But even before that, in destroying the Roman Empire, they had proved their worth. It is not true, he says, that the Teutonic barbarian conjured up the so-called Knight of the Middle Ages. This knight followed rather upon the intellectual and moral bankruptcy of the raceless chaos of humanity, which the dying Roman Empire had nurtured. But for the Teuton, everlasting night would have settled upon the world. At the time he was writing, he saw in the Teuton the only hope of the world. Chamberlain included among the Teutons, the Celts and the Slavs, though the Teutons were the most important element. However, he is quite woolly in his definitions, and at one point declares that whoever behaves as a Teuton is a Teuton, whatever his racial origin. Perhaps here he was thinking of his own non-German origin. Whatever he was, the Teuton, according to Chamberlain, was the soul of our culture. The importance of each nation as a living power today is dependent upon the proportion of genuinely Teutonic blood in its population. True history begins at the moment when the Teuton, with his masterful hand, lays his grip upon the legacy of antiquity. And the Jews? The longest chapter in Foundations is devoted to them. As we have seen, Chamberlain claimed that the Jews and the Teutons were the only pure races left in the West. And in this chapter he condemns stupid and revolting anti-Semitism. The Jews, he says, are not inferior to the Teuton, merely different. They have their own grandeur. They realize the sacred duty of man to guard the purity of race. And yet, as he proceeds to analyze the Jews, Chamberlain slips into the very vulgar anti-Semitism which he condemns in others, and which leads, in the end, to the obscenities of Julius Streicher's caricatures of the Jews in Der Stürmer in Hitler's time. Indeed, a good deal of the philosophical basis of Nazi anti-Semitism stems from this chapter. The preposterousness of Chamberlain's views is quickly evident. He has declared that the personality of Christ is one of the three great bequests of antiquity to modern civilization. He then sets out to prove that Jesus was not a Jew. His Galilean origins, his inability to utter correctly the Aramaic gutturals, are to Chamberlain clear signs that Jesus had a large proportion of non-Semitic blood. He then makes a typically flat statement. Whoever claimed that Jesus was a Jew was either being stupid or telling a lie. Jesus was not a Jew. What was he then? Chamberlain answers, probably an Aryan. If not entirely by blood, then unmistakably by reason of his moral and religious teaching, so opposed to the materialism and abstract formalism of the Jewish religion. It was natural then, or at least it was to Chamberlain, that Christ should become the God of the young Indo-European peoples overflowing with life, and above all the God of the Teuton, because no other people was so well equipped as the Teutonic to hear this divine voice. There follows what purports to be a detailed history of the Jewish race from the time of the mixture of the Semite or Bedouin of the desert with the round-headed Hittite, who had a Jewish nose, and finally with the Amorites, who were Aryans. Unfortunately, the Aryan mixture, the Amorites, he says, were tall, blonde, magnificent, came too late to really improve the corrupt Hebrew strain. From then on, the Englishman, contradicting his whole theory of the purity of the Jewish race, finds the Jews becoming a negative race, a bastardy, so that the Aryans were justified in denying Israel. In fact, he condemns the Aryans for giving the Jews a halo of false glory. He then finds the Jews lamentably lacking in true religion. Finally, for Chamberlain, the way of salvation lies in the Teutons and their culture. And of the Teutons, the Germans are the highest endowed, for they have inherited the best qualities of the Greeks and the Indo-Aryans. This gives them the right to be masters of the world. God builds today upon the Germans alone, he wrote in another place. This is the knowledge, the certain truth, that has filled my soul for years. Publication of Foundations of the 19th Century created something of a sensation, and brought this strange Englishman sudden fame in Germany. despite its frequent eloquence and its distinguished style, for Chamberlain was a dedicated artist. The book was not easy reading, but it was soon taken up by the upper classes, who seemed to have found in it just what they wanted to believe. Within 10 years it had gone through 8 editions and sold 60,000 copies, and by the time of the outbreak of the First World War in 1914 it had reached a sale of 100,000. It flourished again in the Nazi time, and I remember an announcement of its 24th edition in 1938, by which time it had sold more than 250,000 copies. Among its first and most enthusiastic readers was Kaiser Wilhelm II. He invited Chamberlain to his palace at Potsdam, and on their very first meeting a friendship was formed that lasted to the end of the author's life in 1927. An extensive correspondence between the two followed. Some of the 43 letters which Chamberlain addressed to the emperor, Wilhelm answered 23 of them, were lengthy essays which the ruler used in several of his bombastic speeches and statements. "It was God who sent your book to the German people and you personally to me," the Kaiser wrote in one of his first letters. Chamberlain's obsequiousness, his exaggerated flattery in these letters, can be nauseating. "Your Majesty and your subjects," he wrote, "have been born in a holy shrine," and he informed Wilhelm that he had placed his portrait in his study opposite one of Christ by Leonardo, so that while he worked he often paced up and down between the countenance of his Savior and his Sovereign. His servility did not prevent Chamberlain from continually proffering advice to the headstrong, flamboyant monarch. In 1908 the popular opposition to Wilhelm had reached such a climax that the Reichstag censored him for his disastrous intervention in foreign affairs. But Chamberlain advised the emperor that public opinion was made by idiots and traitors, and not to mind it, whereupon Wilhelm replied that the two of them would stand together. "You wield your pen, I my tongue and my broadsword." And always the Englishman reminded the emperor of Germany's mission and its destiny. "Once Germany has achieved the power," he wrote after the outbreak of the First World War, "and we may confidently expect her to achieve it, she must immediately begin to carry out a scientific policy of genius. Augustus undertook a systematic transformation of the world, and Germany must do the same. Equipped with offensive and defensive weapons, organized as firmly and flawlessly as the army, superior to all in art, science, technology, industry, commerce, finance, in every field, in short, teacher, helmsman, and pioneer of the world, every man at his post, every man giving his utmost for the holy cause. Thus Germany will conquer the world by inner superiority." For preaching such a glorious mission for his adopted country, he became a naturalized German citizen in 1916, halfway through the war, Chamberlain received from the Kaiser the Iron Cross. But it was on the Third Reich, which did not arrive until 6 years after his death, but whose coming he foresaw, that this Englishman's influence was the greatest. His racial theories and his burning sense of the destiny of the Germans in Germany were taken over by the Nazis, who acclaimed him as one of their prophets. During the Hitler regime, books, pamphlets, and articles poured from the presses extolling the spiritual founder of National Socialist Germany. Rosenberg, as one of Hitler's mentors, often tried to impart his enthusiasm for the English philosopher to the Führer. It is likely that Hitler first learned of Chamberlain's writings before he left Vienna, for they were popular among the pan-German and anti-Semitic groups whose literature he devoured so avidly in those early days. Probably, too, he read some of Chamberlain's chauvinistic articles during the war. In Mein Kampf, he expresses the regret that Chamberlain's observations were not more heeded during the Second Reich. Chamberlain was one of the first intellectuals in Germany to see a great future for Hitler, and new opportunities for the Germans if they followed him. Hitler had met him in Bayreuth in 1923, and though ill, half-paralyzed, and disillusioned by Germany's defeat and the fall of the Hohenzollern Empire, the collapse of all his hopes and prophecies, Chamberlain was swept off his feet by the eloquent young Austrian. "You have mighty things to do," he wrote Hitler on the following day. "My faith in Germanism has not wavered an instant, though my hope, I confess, was at a low ebb. With one stroke you have transformed the state of my soul. That in the hour of her deepest need Germany gives birth to a Hitler proves her vitality, as do the influences that emanate from him. For these two things, personality and influence, belong together. May God protect you. This was at a time when Adolf Hitler, with his Charlie Chaplin mustache, his rowdy manners, and his violent, outlandish extremism, was still considered a joke by most Germans. He had few followers then, but the hypnotic magnetism of his personality worked like a charm on the aging ill philosopher and renewed his faith in the people he had chosen to join and exalt. Chamberlain became a member of the budding Nazi Party and, so far as his health would permit, began to write for its obscure publications. One of his articles, published in 1924, hailed Hitler, who was then in jail, as destined by God to lead the German people. Destiny had beckoned Wilhelm II, but he had failed. Now there was Adolf Hitler. This remarkable Englishman's 70th birthday, on September 5, 1925, was celebrated with five columns of encomiums in the Nazi Furkischer Beobachter, which hailed his foundations as the gospel of the Nazi movement. And he went to his grave 16 months later, on January 11, 1927, with high hope that all he had preached and prophesied would yet come true under the divine guidance of this new German Messiah. Aside from a prince representing Wilhelm II, who could not return to German soil, Hitler was the only public figure at Chamberlain's funeral. In reporting the death of the Englishman, the Furkischer Beobachter said that the German people had lost one of the great armorers, whose weapons have not yet found in our day their fullest use. Not the half-paralyzed old man, dying, not even Hitler, nor anyone else in Germany, could have foreseen in that bleak January month of 1927, when the fortunes of the Nazi Party were at their lowest ebb, how soon, how very soon, those weapons which the transplanted Englishman had forged would be put to their fullest use, and with what fearful consequences. Yet Adolf Hitler had a mystical sense of his personal mission on earth in those days, and even before. "From millions of men, one man must step forward," he wrote in Mein Kampf, "who with apodictic force will form granite principles from the wavering idea world of the broad masses, and take up the struggle for their soul correctness, until from the shifting waves of a free thought world there will arise a brazen cliff of solid unity in faith and will." He left no doubt in the minds of readers that he already considered himself that one man. Mein Kampf is sprinkled with little essays on the role of the genius who is picked by Providence to lead a great people, even though they may not at first understand him or recognize his worth, out of their troubles to further greatness. The reader is aware that Hitler is referring to himself and his present situation. He is not yet recognized by the world for what he is sure he is, but that has always been the fate of geniuses, in the beginning. "It nearly always takes some stimulus to bring the genius on the scene," he remarks. The world then resists and does not want to believe that the type, which apparently is identical with it, is suddenly a very different being, a process which is repeated with every eminent son of man. "The spark of a genius," he declares, "exists in the brain of the truly creative man from the hour of his birth. True genius is always inborn and never cultivated, let alone learned." Specifically, he thought, the great men who shaped history were a blend of the practical politician and the thinker. At long intervals in human history, it may occasionally happen that the politician is wedded to the theoretician. The more profound this fusion, the greater are the obstacles opposing the work of the politician. He no longer works for necessities, which will be understood by the first good shopkeeper, but for aims which only the fewest comprehend. Therefore, his life is torn between love and hate. The protest of the present, which does not understand him, struggles with the recognition of posterity, for which he also works. For the greater a man's works are for the future, the less the present can comprehend them, the harder his fight. These lines were written in 1924, when few understood what this man, then in prison and discredited by the failure of his comic opera Putsch, had in mind to do. But Hitler had no doubts himself. Whether he actually read Hegel or not is a matter of dispute, but it is clear from his writings and speeches that he had some acquaintance with the philosopher's ideas, if only through discussions with his early mentors Rosenberg, Eckhart, and Hesse. One way or another, Hegel's famous lectures at the University of Berlin must have caught his attention, as did numerous dictums of Nietzsche. We have seen briefly that Hegel developed a theory of heroes, which had great appeal to the German mind. In one of the Berlin lectures, he discussed how the will of the world spirit is carried out by world historical individuals. They may be called heroes inasmuch as they have derived their purposes and their vocation, not from the calm, regular course of things sanctioned by the existing order, but from a concealed fount, from that inner spirit still hidden beneath the surface, which impinges on the outer world as on a shell and bursts it into pieces. Such were Alexander, Caesar, Napoleon. They were practical, political men, but at the same time they were thinking men who had an insight into the requirements of the time, what was ripe for development. This was the very truth for their age, for their world. It was theirs to know this nascent principle, the necessary directly sequent step in progress, which their world was to take, to make this their aim and to expend their energy in promoting it. World historical men, the heroes of an epoch, must therefore be recognized as its clear-sighted ones. Their deeds, their words, are the best of their time. Note the similarities between this and the above quotation from Mein Kampf. The fusion of the politician and the thinker, that is what produces a hero, a world historical figure, an Alexander, a Caesar, a Napoleon. If there was in him, as Hitler had now come to believe, the same fusion, might he not aspire to their ranks? In Hitler's utterances there runs the theme that the supreme leader is above the morals of ordinary man. Hegel and Nietzsche thought so too. We have seen Hegel's argument that the private virtues and irrelevant moral claims must not stand in the way of the great rulers, nor must one be squeamish if the heroes, in fulfilling their destiny, trample or crush to pieces many an innocent flower. Nietzsche, with his grotesque exaggeration, goes much further. The strong men, the masters, regain the pure conscience of a beast of prey. Monsters filled with joy, they can return from a fearful succession of murder, arson, rape, and torture with the same joy in their hearts, the same contentment in their souls as if they had indulged in some student's rag. When a man is capable of commanding, when he is by nature a master, when he is violent in act and gesture, of what importance are treaties to him? To judge morality properly, it must be replaced by two concepts borrowed from zoology: the taming of a beast, and the breeding of a specific species. Such teachings, carried to their extremity by Nietzsche and applauded by a host of lesser Germans, seem to have exerted a strong appeal on Hitler. A genius with a mission was above the law. He could not be bound by bourgeois morals. Thus, when his time for action came, Hitler could justify the most ruthless and cold-blooded deeds, the suppression of personal freedom, the brutal practice of slave labor, the depravities of the concentration camp, the massacre of his own followers in June 1934, the killing of war prisoners, and the mass slaughter of the Jews. When Hitler emerged from Landsberg prison 5 days before Christmas 1924, he found a situation which would have led almost any other man to retire from public life. The Nazi Party and its press were banned. The former leaders were feuding and falling away. He himself was forbidden to speak in public. What was worse, he faced deportation to his native Austria. The Bavarian state police had strongly recommended it in a report to the Ministry of the Interior. Even many of his old comrades agreed with the general opinion that Hitler was finished, that now he would fade away into oblivion, as had so many other provincial politicians who had enjoyed a brief moment of notoriety during the strife-ridden years when it seemed that the Republic would totter. As late as 1929, Professor M. A. Gerotvol, the editor of Lord Dabernon's diaries, wrote a footnote to the ambassador's account of the beer hall putsch in which, after mention of Hitler's being sentenced to prison, he added, "He was finally released after 6 months and bound over for the rest of his sentence, thereafter fading into oblivion." Lord Dabernon was the British ambassador in Berlin from 1920 to 1926 and worked with great skill to strengthen the Weimar Republic. But the Republic had weathered the storms. It was beginning to thrive. While Hitler was in prison, a financial wizard by the name of Dr. Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht had been called in to stabilize the currency, and he had succeeded. The ruinous inflation was over. The burden of reparations was eased by the Dawes Plan. Capital began to flow in from America. The economy was rapidly recovering. Stresemann was succeeding in his policy of reconciliation with the Allies. The French were getting out of the Ruhr. A security pact was being discussed, which would pave the way for a general European settlement, Locarno, and bring Germany into the League of Nations. For the first time since the defeat, after 6 years of tension, turmoil, and depression, the German people were beginning to have a normal life. 2 weeks before Hitler was released from Landsberg, the Social Democrats, the November criminals, as he called them, had increased their vote by 30% to nearly 8 million in a general election in which they had championed the Republic. The Nazis, in league with northern racial groups under the name of the National Socialist German Freedom Movement, had seen their vote fall from nearly 2 million in May 1924 to less than 1 million in December. Nazism appeared to be a dying cause. It had mushroomed on the country's misfortunes. Now that the nation's outlook was suddenly bright, it was rapidly withering away. Or so most Germans and foreign observers believed. But not Adolf Hitler. He was not easily discouraged. And he knew how to wait. As he picked up the threads of his life in the little two-room apartment on the top floor of 41 Tierschstrasse in Munich during the winter months of 1925, and then when summer came in various inns on the Obersalzberg above Berchtesgaden, the contemplation of the misfortunes of the immediate past and the eclipse of the present served only to strengthen his resolve. Behind the prison gates he had had time to range over in his mind not only his own past and its triumphs and mistakes, but the tumultuous past of his German people and its triumphs and errors. He saw both more clearly now, and there was born in him anew a burning sense of mission, for himself and for Germany, from which all doubts were excluded. In this exalted spirit he finished dictating the torrent of words that would go into Volume 1 of Mein Kampf, and went on immediately to Volume 2. The blueprint of what the Almighty had called upon him to do in this cataclysmic world, and the philosophy, the Weltanschauung, that would sustain it, were set down in cold print for all to ponder. That philosophy, however demented, had roots, as we have seen, deep in German life. The blueprint may have seemed preposterous to most 20th-century minds, even in Germany, but it too possessed a certain logic. It held forth a vision. It offered, though few saw this at the time, a continuation of German history. It pointed the way toward a glorious German destiny.